May it please the court, Molly Odom for Mr. Juan Carlos Vargas. This case presents a simple but stark example of prosecutorial misconduct that renders a trial fundamentally unfair, requiring reversal. During rebuttal closing, the prosecutor argued the jury could infer Mr. Vargas' guilty knowledge because he failed to make exculpatory statements after his arrest. The prosecutor knew that this argument was false. In fact, the prosecutor had insisted that Mr. Vargas' exculpatory statement be excluded from evidence and then took advantage of its absence at the very end of the trial to argue Mr. Vargas' guilty knowledge. The prosecutor's conduct smacks of unfairness, and this court should reverse. This is a drug trial case out of Corpus Christi in which, prior to the first trial, the government filed and requested an oral motion in limine to leave out Mr. Vargas' statement that he didn't know that there were drugs in the trailer. The parties agreed to leave that evidence out, and the defense agreed to it, that it wouldn't put him on the stand to get that evidence before the jury and subject him to cross-examination. However, the understanding was, unless the government tried to show that he said something that they believe suggests he's lying to them, or somehow in any way is inconsistent with undeniable facts. And that's where the parties left it.
Were you just reading from the transcript there?
Yes,
I was.
Okay. All right. Yes. Uh-huh. And that was R-393-94. That's the motion in limine prior to the first trial.
Could you read that last thing you just read again?
Yes. The parties agreed that should the government try to show that he said something that they believe suggests that he's lying to them, or somehow in any way is inconsistent with undeniable facts, then the defendant's statement should be admitted. That was the agreement of the parties before the first trial, and the first trial proceeded consistent with that agreement. The second trial proceeded consistent with that agreement as well. Now, I have not made that this is a case in which the prosecutor violated the motion in limine, and the reason was it's because the second trial, it wasn't renewed. So there may be a legal argument with regards to the motion in limine, but the parties proceeded under the spirit of the agreement. During the second trial, there was evidence that came forth with regards to Mr. Vargas' statements. There was evidence that he said that he had just picked up the trailer, he had picked it up in Brownsville, he was taking it to Tyler, that the trailer was sealed. Evidence did not come in with regards to his exculpatory statement that he made that he didn't know that there was marijuana in the trailer. Yet during the closing argument, the prosecutor conveys a false impression that he didn't make any claims of innocence. And the prosecutor makes this argument on rebuttal at the end of the trial, and it's completely contradictory to the agreement that the parties had with regards to its statement, and it's contradictory to the facts that the prosecutor knew. And we know the prosecutor knew that he made this statement because it's something that she insisted be kept out of trial. And that's what makes this fundamentally unfair.
What was the objection at trial to the argument?
There was not an objection. This is on plain error review.
Okay.
This is on plain error review. Yes. And it is a clear error. And that this court has recognized it, and other courts have recognized it. And what makes it an error is that the prosecutor is implying reliance on knowledge or evidence that's not available to the jury. And that's what the First Circuit recognized in Smith. It's an error for the government to make this kind of argument in closing. And the error is clear and obvious because as they recognize in Utechukwu, not only are they implying this reliance on evidence that's not available for the jury.
What precisely is the legal error in admitting this evidence? I'm having a little trouble understanding. This is post silence we're talking about here, and failure to kind of, I guess, in terms of you said the unfairness of it. What is the legal basis of your argument? Is it due process or?
It's a due process violation. I've not made the argument that this is a Doyle issue. Doyle issue comes into play when you're looking at the harm analysis on the plain
error. Well, that's what I'm getting at.
Right.
Why are you resting on due process and not Doyle? Because you can't make the argument under Doyle because he did speak?
He did make the statement mm-hmm. that he had, he didn't, after his arrest, he did make the statement, but then he also made a statement that he was going to exercise his right to silence. I mean, there's not been a Doyle violation.
We have a fairly well-developed body of jurisprudence with regard to the Doyle jurisprudence. Difficult as it may be, it's still fairly well-developed. It seems odd to me to reach into that and not deal with those principles, but rather characterize this in terms of due process as some sort of a residual argument. I don't get that.
Right. The evidence before us is there's not clear
evidence. Let me ask you in a different way. If you don't have a Doyle violation, where is the due process violation? Right.
The due process violation is in the government, the prosecutor giving a false impression that he didn't proclaim his innocence and repeatedly making that argument in closing when, in fact, he did proclaim his innocence. And the prosecutor knew that, kept it out of evidence. That's the error. And there's
so you're resting solely on prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes, prosecutor misconduct.
Okay.
When looking at the conduct of the prosecutor in this case, and when you start doing a Doyle analysis, there are complications because of the general nature of the motion in limine. There's not testimony or evidence with regards to when did he make a statement, when did he do the Miranda warning. It's problematic, but that doesn't erase or eradicate what happened. And what is clear from the record is that the prosecutor was well aware that he did protest his innocence. And similar to the harm analysis in Doyle, you have a prosecutor who is falsely conveying and giving the impression that he remained silent when others would have protested. That's the similarity to Doyle.
Excuse me for interrupting. Uh-huh. Are you saying the evidence is not clear of whether he was given warnings on his rights prior to making the statement?
It's not. There's no testimony with regards to that. They start off the motion in limine saying we would want to keep out his self-serving statements. There is a reference. She does make a reference in that motion in limine hearing, and there is a reference in the PSR that he exercised his right to silence. But it's not clear. And again, we're now into the second trial on this case. The first trial ended up in a mistrial with a split jury. And so you're really looking at what does the prosecutor argue? You're looking at the government, the prosecutor's conduct, and you're looking at the effect of that conduct on the jury. And what she is saying is he didn't express his innocence. And she comes to that point when she is addressing the elements of the offense. You have drugs, you have the quantity, the type are stipulated to. You have the fact that Mr. Vargas did indeed possess it. But when the prosecutor starts talking about knowledge, that's when she latches onto this theory that he would have made a statement protesting his innocence. And she says, that would be reasonable, wouldn't it? It doesn't make any sense. Common sense tells you he would have said something to the effect of, Garza did it if he had been set up. And that was the defense's theory in the case, was that the evidence shows, when you are weighing the evidence in this case, Garza is suspicious. It is Garza's trailer that Mr. Vargas has picked up. It's Garza's trailer that he picked up at Garza's site of business. It's Garza's bill of lading that's the fake bill of lading that he was used. And it's Garza who is hauling old clothes that are used for rags.
Let me ask you a question with regard to the characterization of the statement as a due process violation, but it does not violate, as to his use of silence, wrongful statement, and not violating Doyle jurisprudence. What do you say to the argument that at best this demonstrates an insufficient uncertainty about the law that any error was not plain? Now, we've recently emphasized again that plain error, the threshold matter, deals with obvious error. And you have, is this a public defender defending this case? You have an experienced defense lawyer defending the case, does not object to it. That tells you something. And the law itself here, as you describe it, the argument would go is not that clear. How do you handle that argument in a plain error context?
The counsel missed it. He missed it during closing argument. He missed that she was pointing to things that he didn't say. But it still doesn't mean that there hasn't been an error here that's clear, particularly when you look at...
Well, what's the clearest statement that this violates due process, although it doesn't violate Doyle, the Doyle principles? You said it's not a Doyle case, but it's misconduct.
It's misconduct to give the impression that he would have protested his innocence, that he would have made a statement with regards to his innocence, when the government knew that, in fact, he had made that statement. She's reviewing the statements, and she's telling the jury that they don't have to weigh the evidence. Look at his statements. He never protested his innocence. He didn't make that type of claim. When the prosecutor knew that he had, that's the error. That's what makes it fundamentally unfair. It was kept out of evidence, and then this argument is raised during the closing rebuttal. That's the due process violation, to keep it out of evidence.
And use make sure context for this. I mean, you can have an advocate misstate the evidence, and you have general instructions that, you know, argument of counsel is not evidence, jury rely on what you heard, and there could have been an objection. It seems to me if that were the situation, this evidence was actually before the jury, the error is not nearly so substantial. Your concern is, it seems to me, more focused on when rebuttal with no chance to respond, the prosecutor was putting into evidence something that was not true, both that was not in evidence, talking about things that were not in evidence, but also were demonstrably false. I'm making it plural. It's one statement. Is that the due process error, that evidence not in the record and, in fact, was not true was being told to the jury?
That's the error that occurred in this case, yes. And what makes it harmful and where it violates his substantial rights is that this type of argument by the government, where it's pointing to a lack of evidence and where the government is giving specific examples of what he would have said. She's not just making general references or asking the jury to infer this. She is specifically arguing that there is a lack of evidence, there's a lack of protest, no claim of innocence, and that's what people do when they've been duped. That's what they do and they don't know. And she ties each of these arguments into knowledge. She starts with, look at the amount of drugs in the truck. There's over $1 million worth of drugs. And if someone doesn't know and they've been duped, they would say, I've been set up. Wouldn't that be reasonable? Wouldn't that be a reasonable thing to do? Everything he did on that night tells you that Mr. Vargas didn't, that he knew, because you never heard Garza did it. Wouldn't that be reasonable? Wouldn't that be something you would hear? Well, what would be reasonable is for someone to say, if he'd been set up, I didn't know that there were drugs in the truck, particularly with the evidence in this case, where you have a lot of problems with Garza's testimony. And it completely transcends a general jury instruction when you have this type of argument being made, where she's essentially saying, you can ignore the evidence because he didn't make exculpatory statements, that's guilt. And that's the problem. They don't have to weigh the credibility of the evidence. They can just say, but he didn't protest his innocence, and he didn't get up here on the stand and proclaim his innocence. That's what makes this unfair. And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Ms. Odom. You save time for rebuttal. Mr. Dowd.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ms. Odom. First of all, the government did not commit misconduct in this case. The government did not argue that the jury could infer guilt or knowledge of the marijuana by virtue of Mr. Vargas's failure to proclaim his innocence at the time he made a statement. The government's statement, and I'll go to the third, identified as the third instance in the government brief. This is what the prosecutor argued in closing argument in rebuttal. Everything Vargas did that night of his arrest says to you the defendant knew, because you never heard Garza did it. Let me tell you about him. Now, each one of these instances of the prosecutor citing this lack of mention of Garza is tied directly to, and it's made in the context of Mr. Vargas's defense. And the jury was confronted with an unusual case where you had the government's scenario of what happened, and then you had a fully developed scenario presented by Mr. Vargas of Garza being the drug manipulative drug trafficker who duped Mr. Vargas. So each one of these instances is a narrowly focused comment by the government to defeat Mr. Vargas's defense. It's not the generalized statement that the fact he made no exculpatory statement at the time of his statement. By that, you can ignore the evidence and infer his guilt. The government never did that. And again, this was something that got by the experienced public defender at trial. The public defender never objected, never asked to reopen. He reserved the right to bring this evidence in the motion in limine hearing. So we're under plain error review. The defendant has to establish that he was deprived of a fair trial, and this had a substantial influence on the result of the trial.
What do you do to the statement? Everything Vargas did on the night of his arrest says to you the defendant knew because you never heard, and he says Enrico did it, et cetera, et cetera. While he didn't say, he didn't make explicit reference to the want of a denial. I mean, to me, that they're saying you didn't offer exculpatory material. You didn't tell us you were innocent. And he says, but the statement that he did make was he didn't know there was marijuana in the trial. He tells them that in the trailer. He tells them there's no marijuana in there, but then the government doesn't explicitly refer to that. But they're talking about a want of a failure of explanation. You didn't explain this. You could have explained this. You could have pointed, but anyway, you should have been saying, it's reasonable to expect him saying, Enrico set me up. That doesn't that come very close to saying that you didn't? What do you do with this statement that you knew that the guy denied it? They knew it. I mean, they just didn't deal with it.
Yes, Your Honor. If the statement was simply, everything Vargas did the night of his arrest says to you the defendant knew, period, that would be a problem. But the fact that the statement continues and references Mr. Garza, because you never heard Garza did it, let me tell you about that. You have to consider these statements not as generalized, categorized exculpatory statements as counsel argues, but rather in the context in which they're offered. And the context is clear. The jury understood that it related to the fact that he never mentioned Mr. Garza in his statement, that at the time of the trial, this was a new defense, and it conflicted with his original statement to Border Patrol. Apparently, counsel even missed it because there was no objection. So, I mean, if you look at these statements in the context in which they were made, how they would have been interpreted by the jury, then I think the burden, counsel fails in the burden to demonstrate misconduct.
Mr. Dowd, let me ask you, as I understand it, you're focusing on what you have in your brief as the third time that the government did something that's been complained about.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
It's the point Judge Higginbotham, when you said it first and Judge Higginbotham repeated it, you never heard Enrique Garza did it. Let me tell you about it. Now, that is, as I understand it, the focus of this argument. It's not the only thing, but this is the key part of it.
Yes, sir.
And is your position basically that even if this evidence had come in, that he denied knowing the drugs were there, this would still have been a proper statement? I mean, are you trying to make this distinction that if he really didn't know they were there, he would have been talking about Garza as opposed to not talking about Garza? So is your position that this is consistent even with the evidence that the prosecutor had in her head, I guess it was, the prosecutor did, that she knew that there had been a denial by Vargas on the night of the arrest?
Well, to literally apply the statement, it does suggest that he didn't do anything the night of his arrest that indicated he didn't know, and that would not be correct. But again, if you look at the context of the statement, it was clear that the prosecutor was intending, maybe inartfully, to comment on the absence of this whole Garza version in his post-arrest statement. And I think the jury would have understood it in that manner, and that's how it was intended.
Go back to the...
If that's...
How did this get... The subject of a motion in limine. The government, at the outset, wanted to keep away from the jury his denial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you file a motion in limine? And what were the terms, as you understand it, of that understanding?
That was the only statement that was to be kept out.
I'm sorry. What were the conditions of that?
I think counsel described it accurately. But if the government introduced something that would contradict that or put that in issue, then the defense reserved the right to bring in his denial of the marijuana at the checkpoint.
Did that ruling mean that in the cross-examination of the government, that witnesses, that the counsel could not elicit the denial?
Unless those conditions were met, unless the government had offered evidence that was contradictory to his denial.
The government's doing here is really jumping on. This goes back to the distinction you're drawing. Step number one in this is that you isolate the denial, right?
Yes, sir.
And you said, and he can't even use it himself in cross-examination unless you put at issue the want of explanation. And then in the rebuttal, you come back and do go right at his want of explanation. Now, you don't talk about the denial, but you talk about a variation of that very powerfully. You go on to argue instead the denial that he ought to have made, which is that Enrico set me up or somebody else did this, not me. But that's cutting it pretty thin, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the denial the government is citing is not the denial of marijuana. It's the fact that he didn't bring up Garza at his post-arrest statement. And that's repeated through the trial. I think there's three instances where the government argues that Mr. Vargas never cited Mr. Garza's involvement at the time of his post-arrest statement. And in the context of the trial in which the jury is confronted with two distinct scenarios, one with Garza, the drug trafficker, duping Vargas, and one the other way around with Vargas, the drug trafficker, I mean, it's clear the government was attacking Mr. Vargas's defense. And I think everybody...
Yes, you tied his hand behind his back to keep out of evidence that he made a denial, and then you make a very pointed argument that his denial was not that Enrico set me up. So, I mean, it really did reinforce, I must say, it reinforced your argument to have that his other denial.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not sure that's government misconduct, but it just seems that I'm just trying to describe what happened.
The use of the expansive language was inartful and regrettable, but I don't think it led the jury to consider that, to consider the fact that Mr. Vargas never denied knowledge of the marijuana. You have to realize this is a knowledge drug case coming from the border, and they stipulated to most of the facts. In fact, the only element that was even in controversy was Mr. Vargas's knowledge of the marijuana.
I agree with everything you said. The one thing that jumps out at me that's a bit odd about this is this motion in limine that you were successful, surprisingly, in keeping out and getting to that, to creep the defense, even eliciting by cross-examination that he denied it. And that's a rather strong ruling.
Yes, I would like to cite that there was substantial evidence against Mr. Vargas he has a substantial burden to reverse the case. There was the deficient paperwork, misspelled source of the ropa usada. There was no weight cited in the cargo, no weight tickets, no invoices, manifests, no documents suggesting for whom he was hauling, no phone number for the delivery company. And this would have been a early morning delivery. I think he went through the checkpoint about 11:30 p.m. So he wouldn't be able to call and deliver the goods to Tyler unless he knew it was going. The phone calls from Hedalia Vargas' phone at 10:24 p.m. when Mr. Vargas was well en route. And this phone number was identified in Mr. Vargas's telephone under the name Grande. So he was expecting the call, or at least he knew the caller, and he identified that person as Grande. And then the call from Vargas to Garza a few minutes later for 43 minutes. No calls from Garza or to Garza, from Garza or to Garza to Tyler. His statement, that inferential statement that he is leading the Border Patrol believe he's hauling for P&M Trucking that night, when in fact he's not. And again, the defense of being duped by Garza when that statement didn't come in his post-arrest statement. And again, I just want to emphasize that at a fundamental level, this is a knowledge case. The jury is well aware that Mr. Vargas is denying knowledge of the marijuana. That's the only issue really in controversy. His statements at the checkpoint, I just picked it up. I'm, you know, working for P&M, and I'm just picked up the trailer and I'm dropping it off in Tyler. I mean, all the statements that were offered are in essence exculpatory. They inferentially or indirectly deny knowledge of the load of marijuana. So this would not have been a bombshell for the jury to learn that Mr. Varga, in fact, denied knowledge of the marijuana at the checkpoint. So I think if there was a problem, there's really no prejudice that can be demonstrated. And unless there's any other questions, I'll give up the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dowd. Ms. Odom, you've saved time for rebuttal.
I'd like to start by saying that, yes, the government, the prosecutor was responding to the defense's theory of the case, but the prosecutor went too far. This was not a fair response. The prosecutor, just as Mr. Dowd just did, could have reviewed the evidence that was before the jury, evidence regarding Mr. Vargas, the evidence that they presented against him, and the strengths of Mr. Garza's testimony. The defense's theory of the case was no surprise. The prosecutor, there's no way the prosecutor would have been surprised that this was their theory. This was the same theory that the defense presented in the first trial. The difference is that Garza didn't testify in the first trial. And that just shows you this is what's so problematic about the prosecutor's conduct in this case. During the first trial, in closing argument, the prosecutor said, well, Garza didn't testify because we wouldn't put people up here who lie. And on that one, we objected and asked for a mistrial. Well, Garza did testify in the second trial. There were problems with it. There is evidence to show that his testimony was problematic. And what the government does during its closing argument is says, when the government specifically is getting to the point of knowledge, this is where she latches onto this theory that he would have made a statement blaming Garza. And it's more than just specific statements. She is very, very clear. When she says, Mr. Vargas didn't say that, he didn't say, I got it from Garza. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you should look at it and say, is that reasonable based on these facts? And when she argues that everything Mr. Vargas did on that night, the defendant knew because you never heard, said, proves that he knew because you never heard, and Garza did it, let me tell you about that. She says, wouldn't that be reasonable? Wouldn't that be a reasonable thing to say if he didn't know? She is tying this directly to knowledge. This is the heart of the case, just as Mr. Dowd said. The issue they have to decide is knowledge. And she is repeatedly saying, He did not claim his innocence, and that's what's problematic in this case. After having it, successfully having it left out of the trial, and then taking advantage of that omission to make this kind of argument when she knew he had made that statement, it truly is problematic. I was going to make a point, but I believe Judge Higginbotham hit on it. Mr. Dowd was saying that, well, she's not really saying he didn't know. She's arguing that she would have blamed Garza. And I do believe that the statement that he made is the functional equivalent, and given the facts of this case, and is consistent with someone saying, I didn't do it. And you look at the facts that it's Garza's trailer, you look at the facts it's Garza's bill of lading, that it's Garza that hauls clothes, that it's Garza that called Vargas as Vargas is hauling this, and they had a 40-minute conversation.
Yes. What refresh my memory, what were the exculpatory statements that did come into evidence? That particular denial was, but there was other evidence about his explanation.
That he had just picked up the trailer. He just picked it up in Brownsville. And so what she does, she even takes that and says, well, he would have said more than that. He would have said it was Garza's trailer, that I just picked it up from Garza. So she even takes that and latches it to this theory that she has that he's not protesting his innocence or making those claims. Okay, I just want to cite one other thing, and because I think that this is to the point, and this is from Yudichukwa, and it says that during its closing argument, the prosecutor's persistent theme in argument suggesting the non-existence of information and even the opposite of what the government knew fatally tainted the trial. And I believe that's what happened in this case, and this court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Odom. Your case is under submission. Court will take a brief recess.